manager, fundraiser, and consultant, Laura Sumner Kuhn, a former journalist with the Racine Journal-Times, who currently serves as an adjunct instructor at UW Parkside, and Jane Herring, a former marketing manager at Gateway Technical College. Community Matters shares its time slot with the WGTD Radio Theater. And now, here's today's program.
Good morning. This is Len Iaquinta for Community Matters, and our topic this morning is addressing systemic racism in the city of Kenosha. My guests today include Pastor Roy Peoples, co-chair of the Kenosha's Commit to Action Roadmap, and Kenosha Interim Police Chief Eric Larson. But we'll start with Pastor Peoples. Good morning, Pastor Peoples.
Well, good morning. It's good to be here.
Thank you
for inviting me.
Thank you for joining us, and we're pre-recording this on Tuesday, June 1st. Happy June. Pastor Peoples, why don't we begin by just reviewing a little bit of how this started? And I'm going to read from one of the official documents. In June 2020, the mayor, John Antaramian, convened a small group of area faith-based leaders that he meets with on a quarterly basis, and he asked the group to help with creating a long-term response to the killing of George Floyd, and if they could help with creating a plan to address systemic racism in the city of Kenosha. And you have become the co-chair of the Kenosha Commit to Action Roadmap. Pastor Peoples, to tell us a little bit about the Commit to Action Roadmap and how you got involved way back in June, almost a year ago.
Yes, a good question. Well, you know, how we got here was early on, as you says, the mayor had invited, he was meeting with various clergy from the community because he thought that one is that, first of all, we're leaders in the community, so therefore he could not only hear a voice from the community or from its leaders, and so he brought the clergy in to kind of have those kind of discussions. He gave us updates on a regular basis. Within that, those meetings shortly after, the mayor requested help from the response, as you said earlier, the killing of George Floyd. And so, we needed some help as he requested that he wanted to address systemic racism in the city of Kenosha. And so the initial planning group started from what we call a core team of leaders during that time. And the whole action roadmap objectives, if we say, what's the overview, is to bring the community leaders and citizens together to identify the most effective strategies that we could and solutions that we could muster from a core team to address core system changes in the area of the city. So that was the first thing. Being the first stage of this, we wanted to make this sustainable. And so one of the things that we did was we said, okay, so it's going to be a four-year plan. We know that change doesn't happen overnight, and we know that other groups are doing things, but we wanted to focus on what we call the action roadmap to lay the foundation for a long-term plan that would address systemic racism and really relate to the key focus areas that we have identified that we should talk about. Initially, we had five. Later in the discussion, we added two more. And so the first one was community, what we call community policing, or community, relationships with the community. And we wanted to make sure that the death of Black men that was happening in the community, that we would address this because we feel that criminal justice was being at the forefront of our communities, not only in Kenosha, but nationwide. And so we wanted to address that. The second thing that we wanted to do is we wanted to address what we call criminal justice. That would be the second piece to this, where we would bring things to, how we say it, to focus of how our justice system was working in Kenosha and see if we can make it better. Then we said, there's some unrest amongst our youth. You know, we was not only our youth seem to be not at the table and we want to hear their voices. And so what we did is we invited, we wanted to have a key area where we actually start talking about their grievances, first of all. What did you think? And what was on their mind? And how do we help them with housing and education and employment and become effective? Because they do live in our city and they do have a part to be inclusive of every citizen. And so he says, okay, so once that happens, what about employment? We wanted to have a vigorous employment area, and we're talking about systemic racism now. We want to make sure that the proportionate share of good jobs and as it related to our community went to everyone equally. We didn't want no disparities there. And then we says, okay, so what are we gonna do next? And that with education, we know that education is what you probably heard is the new currency. And so we wanted to make sure that the minority students and education, that they would have equal opportunity. After this went on for a while, after our listening sessions went forward, then two more came out than the other one. So we expanded our areas to address was mental health. Mental health started impacting our communities, the lack of services or access to it, or in our communities, especially for people of color, was very important that we address this, this mental health disparities based on the minority ratio and income and all of these things that was we call indicators start kind of showing us that we should be talking about mental health. And the other one was housing. We wanted safe housing for everyone, safe communities for everyone. And so we start talking about those. And so those are our seven areas that we wanted to address in what we call Kenosha Action, our roadmap. And so, as we said, this is not the end all and be all, because there's although multiple groups that's maybe out there working on some things, we just want to be stakeholders in our community to have our voices heard across the board, you know, whether they was teachers, whether they was community activists, whether they was employers, whatever it was, we wanted everyone to have a voice. Because we just didn't want to, one of the things I always say is, we just don't want to give answers to fix something. What we was trying to find is actual solutions to sustain what we was trying to sustain over time, you know.
Well, that's a very, very broad and comprehensive outlook, and it's going to take a lot of work and a lot of thinking and a lot of people. Now, I was looking to see who was the other co-chair of your working group. But who is the other co-chair, Pastor?
It's a young man out of, I think it's Second Baptist Church, and his name is Demetrius Crum. He's an executive at Allstate. And so he's been very busy, you know, this climate that we're in. I'm sure that HR people are very busy during this time. And so we've been kind of talking offline, strategizing, making plans and those kind of things. So Demetrius Crum is his name, Pastor Demetrius Crum.
Thank you. Now, I've been trying to, over the past few weeks, trying to be clear in my own mind as to the auspices of the committee and how it's related to the administration of the city of Kenosha. And statement in the official document that came out earlier this year was that from the beginning, it was clear that this plan must be developed and owned by the community and not the city of Kenosha. Administration was instrumental in creating the concept and a catalyst for convening the leaders to begin their work. And there is also a coordinator, Catherine Marks, from the mayor's office as well, working with you. Could you just clarify for our listeners and for me exactly what the relationship of the Kenosha Commit to Action Roadmap working groups are to the city administration, and how you work with the city, and whether or not you get secretarial and research support from the city? I'm just not clear on how that works.
Well, I definitely want to applaud the mayor for his foresight and wisdom of putting, let's say, initiating this and launching this kind of initiative. So if you say, how does the city administration play a part to this? And I always say this, right? Someone has to be able to clear out the debris, kind of set the stage for us, and then hand it off to the necessary leaders that's in our community, that's close to our communities, and at this time was a faith-based community. I'm involved, Pastor Crum was involved, and there was many other, and I'll name some of these as we talk. Bob Griffith is a pastor, Mitchell Monroe, all of these, we thought that the faith-based leaders would be a good start to actually to take the lead on this rather than the city. And so we were approached it like that. And so the relationship between the city and this group called Kenosha Action Roadmap in terms of structure now looks like this. And so you have co-chairs, and in those co-chairs, they actually plan, strategy, research, evaluate, research out, and convene these meetings. And so he says, what do we need to make this easier? So we need a liaison, and that was community, what we call a Kenosha community outreach, which Catherine Marks is. And that was a good start for us to say, well, we got the city personnel on there, and that helps us to kind of navigate some things there in terms of resources. The second piece to this that had is that we brought in a Zeitler group to actually to help us to run the meetings, schedule the meetings, take notes and those kind of things. So the group or sub teams could actually focus on the things that we had to focus on. And that is research, evaluation, strategy, those kind of things, running the meetings, being able to get in touch with people, have those conversations, create reporting. We did that. So those are two pieces. So the community outreach, Catherine Marks, helped us to navigate resources and contacts and networks so as to do that.
Well,
the Zeitler Group came in. Pardon me?
Oh, go ahead.
The Zeitler Group came in and helped us with facilitating meetings and all of those kinds of things.
So will that relationship with Zeitler Group continue to be a resource for you, do you expect?
Well, as I said before, they have been instrumental in helping us starting meetings, to meet our objectives and help us to kind of formulate and stay on task. And so here's my hope and my desire that anyone wants to work with the city to move Kenosha forward, we welcome them. You know, we do welcome them.
Do you have a budget to hire anyone you need to help you do with research, or are there personnel in the city who you can rely on to supply you with information that you need so you don't, your volunteers don't have to do all the work themselves?
Yeah, so from kind of put two questions in one here. Let's see if we can separate it in that. So if we're talking about from a sheer resource perspective in terms of funding and those kind of things, we leave that totally up to the city to see exactly. We make a recommendation, we talk about our needs, and then we get, if there's appropriate funds for that, then we ascertain those funds. If you talk about people and businesses and connections and those kind of things, Catherine Marks has been very instrumental in helping us to identify people that could help us to actually facilitate our outcomes.
Well, I can't think of anyone better than Catherine Marks to help you do that. She has a long experience in the city and knows where lots of the levers are and knows how this city works inside and out. That's for sure.
Yes.
Now,
yes.
I'd like to then delve into what you've accomplished in the past year, Pastor Peoples. The draft report that was put online in early in the year, I think it was in February, talked about phase one, and phase one is now over. Phase two is supposed to start in June of 2021, and here we are recording this on the first day of June. Why don't you summarize for us briefly where you are now and what's going to be next, sir?
Okay. Well, as you said before, if you look back at June 2020 or last year, phase one was gathering information based on our desired outcomes that we wanted. And so we wanted to make sure that we convened the groups, right? And those groups will be given individual assignments. We have to make sure that we selected a group. I want to stop for a minute. We selected a group that we could use as a model, you know, to help us kind of help us with the other key areas discussion. We can't do it all at one time, right? And so you would agree that we can't eat the elephant all at one time. We have to take small bites.
Yes.
And so one of the things we did was we says, let's take the police relations, a key area that we want to talk about, and let that be our model, and let's build the strategy and build a tactical plan of how we would move and bring about our goals and objectives. And so we did that. That was phase one, is to make sure that we address those areas that we wanted to address from the police. And so we did that. Formed a team, identified our leaders that was gonna actually take that. So you have your chairs, then you have your co-chairs, and that would have been, at the time, we're talking about the police now, our relations one, we had Pastor Mitchell from Agape. We had Pastor Bob Griffith from Journey. They was actually the co-leads for the police relations. Then we formed these sub-teams that we had, because that was one of our phase one, is how do we do that? We need a team to address the specific areas in the police. And one was policies and procedures, was Jonathan Barker from Grace Lutheran. Then we had, if you say, the community relations, that's where we kind of say the rubber meets the road. That was Pastor Kirby led that. Then we had training. We took the leader, Bob Griffith, and we put him in training because that was his skill set at the time. He loves training. And so he took over the training sub-team. And we had a guy that was in the recruitment, but he kind of ran into some personal issues that he had to take care. And so he stepped back. And then the guy, Steve Hansen, from the police, actually took that over to help us with that. And so those are the four areas that we start talking about in our phase one, is how do we create these sub teams and leaders and team members to actually address the areas, like in police recruitment, what the policy procedures would be, how do we get into the community. And they researched that, evaluated and researched all of the areas, even what other states was doing, what other cities was doing, other things that would be out there, brought it back, and we evaluated to see how we would do what, how would we identify how can we use these things in Kenosha and how would they fit into Kenosha's environment. That's what
it is. If a listener wanted to submit ideas to these committees, how would they do that? I was trying to find online a list of the subcommittees and who they are and how to contact. And I wasn't able to navigate in the city website to find that list. So I wonder if you would just quickly tell our listeners, if they want to get in touch with someone to address those issues and give their input, how do they do that?
Okay, so it's two things. I was thinking that it was on the website, and I have to check that. So we're talking about our model or our concept, what we wanted to use as a police. We says, okay, so how do we contact the police sub team called policies and procedures? That would be Jonathan Barker, right? How do we do our community from our Kirby? And most of these individuals in our community know who these individuals are, right? For recruiting and for training. This is what I would say. This is what I would do if I wanted to do that. I would go to the city website and I would send an email to that address, to that, to the community outreach people, and we can disseminate that information to the person that needs that information. That's so what I would do.
Catherine Marks could be sort of a central clearinghouse, that you're saying.
And that would be one person, or myself.
All right. And you can be found very easily online as well. Yes. Now, yes. One of the things that was an objective for year one was to work on becoming a My Brother's Keeper community. Do you want to talk with us a little bit about that, Pastor Peoples, and where that we are in that progress? This is a very interesting program that I think is very laudable.
Yeah, it was one of the ideas that was put before the My Brother's Keeper. Of course, if you know that came out of President Obama's kind of initiative, where he put those things out there. There's some police reform in that and those kind of things. One of the things that we wanted to say is, how did that work in the communities of people of color? How did it work for communities where it was trying to address systemic racism or police reform? Only thing that we did there was kind of study that document, evaluated to see exactly if there was anything there that we could use. The team is still doing that as we speak. They're looking at that document.
When do you think that some recommendations or suggestions for progress on specific steps to ameliorate systemic racism might be coming forth? Will it wait until June of 2024, the end of the first four-year phase, as this is conceived? I know this is conceived of successive four-year phases. Do you expect those to be issued at any time as soon as a subgroup is ready? How is that going to work?
I'm so glad, and that's a great question, because I think that all of our community is just waiting. We call it our milestone, right? And so we've been meeting and we've been discussing and we've been doing these things. And like I tell we definitely had to sit down and listen. We really had to listen to the community. We had to work some things out from an interview. We had to work some things out from how we evaluate what everybody else is doing. Before we even start talking about how do we solve these problems, we need to know what problems we're trying to solve in our own community. Well, one of the things that we said is, and it's a good question, because the end of the question says, do we have to wait to 2024 to know this? No. One of the things that we asked the group to do, especially from a modeling standpoint, we asked the policies and procedures to say, listen, give us one and two recommendations right now that we can move forward. And you're going to see those in June 2021. And you're going to see some of these things. We asked each group to do this. The only team that you're probably going to be 1 month behind them is the recruitment, because we got kind of started late. We had a leader and then we didn't have a leader. So we had to go back and train another leader, bring him in, bring him up stuff so that he can kind of put these things out, you know, because we wanted that to come from the community. We want the community involved, and we want those recommendations to come from that community. So they're going to come out in July, the recruitment, but the other three is going to come out this month. You'll see those recommendations.
Well, we'll stay tuned, and I'm sure we'll be having more coverage on WGTD Community Matters and other programs, long form and short news breaks on what's happening. As I close out my conversation with you this morning, Pastor Peoples, could you just share with me your hope, your vision? Where do you hope we'll be in another 4 years? What's your vision?
You know, the outcomes is what we really want, right? We want some change. And so we're trying to, this is what we say. After we review and bring all these things together, we want to see change in our community where the community is working together. So you're going to see families, they're going to organizations and business and government, all of us working together, you know, we're working together to bring a better, I call it a, it's an outcome where all of us are working together. We're being inclusive. We have some equity and equality in everything that we do for all of its citizens. That would be a great model for the nation to see, is how a community called Kenosha was hurting and how we found solutions and how we implemented those solutions from the people. The people had their voices. We listened to it and we tried to put those things into place. That would be ideal.
Thank you very much, Pastor awesome. Peoples. We appreciate you being with us today.
Well, thank you.
And now we're going to talk with our Kenosha Interim Police Chief, Eric Larson. Good morning, Chief Larson.
Good morning.
Chief Larson, we're recording this a couple of days before broadcast, just in case something comes up. I want our listeners to be aware of that. I wanted to talk with you a little bit about, first of all, staffing issues with the Kenosha Police Department. We've heard a lot over the last several weeks about a number of resignations, and that the department is a bit short-staffed compared to your normal staffing levels. Could you tell us a little bit about that and some of the background, please, sir?
So we've always done typically a recruitment every year or two. And recently, for various reasons, we've had a number of people leave. We had several people leave to go back to their hometowns and get law enforcement jobs there. There's been a large number of openings in law enforcement kind of period. It's been trending towards difficulties in recruiting and retention. And so we've lost someone to their hometown. We've lost, I believe the last count was 10 due to the civil unrest and people deciding that law enforcement wasn't for them. And then just general attrition because of retirement and the like. So currently our staffing levels are lower than typical, but we plan to hopefully be fully staffed in the next year and a half.
I wonder if you could give us a little insight into the resignations keyed to the civil unrest that we've experienced here in Kenosha and that's been experienced around the country. This isn't something odd about Kenosha because we're getting reports from all over the country that this is an issue. Could you give us a little bit of an insight into that in terms of what people are telling you?
Well, I think what it was is probably, you know, you would hear people say maybe, you know, this isn't what I signed on for or something like that. But what the civil unrest was it was kind of a sustained stressor, if you will, which is kind of uncommon for our line of work. They described law enforcement is kind of described along the lines of anyone that's been in the military knows that it's, you know, 99% boredom, you know, 1% sheer terror. You know, we typically aren't operating at those significant stress levels for extended periods of time. And we did in late August. And I think for some people, it's, you know what, there are other options available. And so they chose to leave. And that's the other thing. That's one of the things overall that we're fighting is, you know, there are plenty of jobs out there right now. And we actually have a very educated workforce, a better educated workforce than we had in the past. People that we're looking at hiring now, they have master's degrees and, you know, bachelor's degrees, where 20, 25 years ago, it was, you know, a two-year degree or no education, actually, in some cases. And so we're hiring people that I would say their careers are more portable. You know, they can move to different places, get into different jobs, even, you know, salaries notwithstanding, you know, there's opportunities. And if you look at people that go into business, you know, they're changing jobs every 3 years and nobody thinks twice about it. In law enforcement, historically, it's been one of those jobs that you enter and you stick around for the pension. And it's just not true anymore just because of there are so many opportunities available. We've lost one of our young officers left because he got a job in as corporate security. You know, and essentially the knowledge he gained here and with his degree and everything positioned him to go into a job with corporate security. So, you know, there's many different things going on and that affect our staffing.
Well, you're right. I see the point that this is a very different environment than when I was a youngster and people enter this as a career, as a lifetime career. And that doesn't apply in any other field. So I guess why should it apply in policing today in 2021, right?
Correct. Yeah, absolutely.
Now, when we talk about replacing these officers, can you talk a little bit about the recruitment process? How is that changing now as we look for the future? And are there changes that you're coming across? I know that some steps were taken by the Police and Fire Commission with respect of making it easier for people in other departments to transfer to Kenosha, as I understood it.
Yeah. So what we're doing is one of the first things we did was historically we had done 2 year recruitments or until a list got shortened. And so we would have a list going for 2 years. And what we did was we essentially shortened that time period up. I believe it was last year, the year before, to essentially 1 year. And the idea was to get fresh faces quicker. And, you know, so we can always grab the best of the best because you're always, you know, having these rotating recruitments. Then as the numbers fell, you know, we went from probably when I started 27 some years ago, we would have close to probably 800 applicants. We're down to 130, 150 or so. And so in addition to that, we've got a pool of certified officers out there that look to change. And so what we've done for them is we've simplified that process. And we just worked out what the process is going to be yesterday with human resources. But we're going to be able to hire certified people outside of the normal recruitment for people that are not certified. And so that gives us a chance to get those certified people in quicker and more often. So we're going to be doing quarterly recruitments essentially for certified people. And that just got posted yesterday, I believe. And again, so this is nothing new. So we're having, you know, we have staffing issues with our clerical staff too, and the city does in other places too. So the key is going to be to try different means of recruitment. Historically, you go to job fairs, things like that, colleges. Platteville is one of the larger criminal justice programs in the state. We travel out there. COVID completely wiped out that concept of job fairs. We have, for minority recruitment, we are looking at doing an event. We're being assisted by a young lady named Olivia Crudup, who has some connections in the community, and she wanted me to promote this affair, but it's Fades with the Fuzz. And so it's going to be at a local barber shop. And essentially what we're going to do is we'll have officers go in there, and the barber shop, you know, if you look back historically, even when I was a kid, you would go to the barber shop with your dad, and there'd be groups of you know, the fathers and the sons there getting their hair cut. And it was a Saturday morning event, you know, once a month for us. It was a Saturday morning event. And so we're looking at doing that non-traditional means of recruiting people, because we don't necessarily recruit the people that we want to with in the past with the means that we were using, you know, because it was mostly college based. And so we'll try anything new, frankly.
Well, that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
That kind of outreach makes a lot of sense, getting really deeper into the community and looking at alternative skill sets. Could you just explain for a moment, though, when you talk about certified officers? I'm not sure that all of our listeners know what that means. Could you briefly explain what's a certified officer?
So a certified officer is an officer that has already been through the academy and has the credentials to be a police officer within the state of Wisconsin. So they don't have to go to the academy. They're all set to hit the road essentially right away.
Well, that sounds like it could step things up. Do you have a timeline where you're hoping to get back up to full strength, or is it a little bit impossible to predict from your standpoint, Chief Larson?
Well, we'll actually... I'm making 13 job officers as we speak. Well, I'm not making them. We're making 13 job officers as we speak right now. And we have a 14th that has already been approved and will be moving into the program. Those 13 job offers, just as a timeline, they would begin the academy August 9th. And they would be finish the academy essentially at the end of the year, because it's 17 weeks. They then would enter our field training program, which is approximately 90 days. So working days, that's about 4.5 months. So the 13 that we hire beginning August 9th would essentially be on their own next May or June, if everything went well as far as the timing and all that. So it's approximately, you know, it's about a 10-month process from hire to solo patrol for an officer. And, you know, it takes time. And then by the time they get out of the academy, because of attrition, retirements and whatnot, I would estimate at January 1st of 2022, we'll have another 10 openings that we'll have to fill. So it'll likely be a year and a half before we're probably fully staffed. But this is nothing new. This has been, you know, the number we have right now is probably the most significant, but it's nothing new as far as being down 10 people or so. We always face that. The interesting thing, for me at least, is in 30 years, if we're low now, 20 filling those spots, in 30 years, minimally, you'll have 20 retirements. So they'll be facing having to hire, you know, 20 retirements plus any other attrition. You know, they could be hiring 30 people in 30 years. And that becomes a, you know, long-term projections like that need to be done, because the academy is going to have to adjust. 30 people in a year is almost, we could have our own academy. So it's interesting. It's something that has to be planned for.
That's quite significant. But you not having trouble covering shifts now, as I understand it from the latest public releases from the police department here in Kenosha. You are covering all the shifts, maybe a little extra overtime now.
Yes, we're covering the shifts, little extra overtime, and we're trying to find creative ways to lessen the workload of the officers that are working.
I wonder if we could talk now and switch to expectations and training and the support we give our police officers, because they have the most stressful possible job you can imagine, and they need support in terms of mental health and training. And it just seems to me that in my lifetime, the expectations we have of our police officers and our sheriff's deputies too have escalated to the point where we expect them not only to be an expert in calming the situation, being able to use weapons effectively, understanding the laws, but we're expecting them to be experts at negotiation, experts at de-escalation, experts at public mental health, experts at suicide prevention. The way we've piled on expectations of our police officers seems to me to be unsustainable. I wonder if you just talk a little bit about how this has changed, and you've seen it. You've been an officer for almost three decades now. How do you view that, Chief Larson?
Yeah, well, I brought up, I spoke at the law enforcement memorial, and that's one of the things I brought up was, you know, the different expectations throughout a shift. And looking back in my days in patrol, which was 20 years ago, but you could be expected at one moment, you could be expected to go help an 80-year-old woman get a bat out of her house. Or, you know, I remember one night I went, an elderly woman had just gotten out of the hospital. It was midnight and her faucet wouldn't turn off because the valve was bad. And I had to go down to the basement and do a little plumbing job for her. And the next, you know, the next moment you could be going to a weapons calls, you know, and where people are firing guns off, things like that. And, you know, the swing goes from, you know, something, I'm not a plumber, you know, and I'm not, you know, pest control. What do I know about bats and things like that? But it's a very good point is, you know, more and more often you'll see that there are things that we are expected to do that we don't necessarily have the best qualifications for. We are first responders. You know, we're problem solvers for that instant. And that's it. And so we don't become experts in fields. And it poses some difficulties. You know, when you talk about crisis intervention, you know, we're the first people to see mental health events. And, you know, what support can someone provide for mental health at, you know, 2:30, 3 o'clock in the morning? What support's available? You know, there's you have crisis, which is limited, you know, crisis workers. There's no other facilities really open at 3 a.m. There's nothing open. So law enforcement becomes the de facto social worker, law enforcement person, and things like that. So there are other programs in other states that serve to provide better services. One of the things that was brought up by Pastor Barker in one of our committee meetings was CAHOOTS, which is a grassroots level volunteer organization or funded a non-governmental organization that works with the mentally ill in Oregon. And so you'll see other programs like that in other cities. That
we have one right nearby in Walworth County. My understanding is that in Delvin and Whitewater, they have full-time counselors who have desks in the police stations. I'm sure you're aware of that. Is that something that you could see as a possible evolution here and elsewhere?
Well, so that certainly provides an alternative person. But frankly, what I'd like to see is have it removed, something like that, removed from the police department responsibility, period. You know, and so it's not necessarily tied to the police department. You know, law enforcement is law enforcement. And I think there's distinct differences between law enforcement and social work. And I think our missions, while they parallel each other, I don't know necessarily that they intersect. And growing up in our city, we had a social worker on the police department also. I believe they did mostly working with kids and things like that. But I don't know necessarily that you have to have them, you know, partnered together in the same building to accomplish those tasks. If anything, I would say you expand the services that are available through other organizations that there's plenty of people that already do that in the city of Kenosha. We have many non-governmental organizations that provide services to people, and maybe it's that those services get expanded.
Well, that makes a lot of sense. And there's talk about having a national a new three-digit number for to call for mental health problems specifically. I'm sure you were aware of that long before I was. This sort of makes me transition into the more general topic of rethinking for the third decade of the 21st century, which is where we stand now, believe it or not. What does public safety and policing mean? People are talking about rethinking, redesigning. Some people are terrified with that idea. Other people think that it's the greatest thing since sliced bread. What are your initial thoughts at this time, Interim Chief Larson, for policing and public safety in the future? Where should we be looking to think about?
Well, I think what we need to rethink is how we look at crime. I promised someone I want to talk about it, but I'm going to, but non-specifically. Historically, crime has always been addressed the same. You know, you call the police show up, someone's arrested, or the problem is solved. And I think what we need to do is follow the path of there's a concept called crime prevention through environmental design. If you look at crime, specifically, I'll talk about Kenosha. I'm a crime stats nut. If you look at Kenosha, property crime has been reduced at almost like a 45 degree angle from 30, 40 years ago to today. Huge drops in property crime. And when you think about it, it makes sense. So in 1987, you know, if I wanted to go and steal a car, I'd break out the window, I'd pop the lock and I'd take off. Nowadays, you almost can't steal a car unless you have the keys because of the electronic devices that provide security. If your car is stolen, it means you left the keys by it. Similarly, you know, burglaries and other property crimes, everyone's got a camera. And, you know, we're solving all these crimes with cameras. So what I'm saying is there's things environmentally there that prevent people, that make them think about committing a crime. And it's called rational choice therapy, is when you weigh the risk and reward of doing something. And so criminals do that. They will do that. They'll look at the car. They'll say, okay, there's no keys. Or they'll go and tug on the car door. A car that is locked, people won't go into. The criminals aren't breaking out windows to get into cars. They'll see if it's unlocked. If it's unlocked, they'll go in. It's that risk-reward behavior. And so we've seen property crime fall off hugely. Now, the difference between that and violent crime is violent crime typically isn't planned. You know, it's in that moment. Emotions are there, and people will get in fights and shoot and do whatever is available. So violent crime has remained fairly stagnant, hasn't fallen off. Now, specifically within the violent crime of aggravated assault, we haven't seen that with all the shootings and the shots fired and things like that. We haven't seen the number of crimes increase, but what they have become is a little more violent. So where previously someone may have been stabbed, now it could be that they're shot. But regardless, violent crime has remained fairly steady. And the question is, how can we reduce that? What can we do differently? Because we've been doing the same thing since, I would argue, since the dawn of time. We've been treating violent crime the same way. So what can we do differently? So one of the things we're doing is, in a couple of weeks, you'll be hearing about a group that's coming out locally that's going to try to interrupt crime before it happens by trying to, you know, members of the community that are going to try to interrupt crime by identifying those situations that may arise where violent crime could be associated. In other words, you know, get there when the emotions are still there and not when the crime is occurring, because typically, we only get there after it's happened.
That sounds very exciting and a wonderful development. I want to just pause for a second before we close to recognize that you've instituted the Kenosha Park Police to help control wanton parking in the wrong places on our beaches. And that sounds like a really great idea. When does that take effect? Is it going to take effect right away?
So we're moving as quick as we can. Right now it's a matter of getting uniforms, getting a vehicle, getting some vinyl wrap and things like that. But as soon as we can get everything together, we're going to hit the streets.
That's terrific. I want to thank my guests for this program on addressing systemic racism in the city of Kenosha. My guests have been Pastor Roy Peoples, co-chair of Kenosha's Commit to Action Roadmap, and Kenosha Interim Police Chief Eric Larson. And as always, I encourage our listeners to get informed and get involved.
This is Len Iaquinta for Community Matters. Good day.
You've been listening to Community Matters. All programs are archived at WGTD.org. Click shows. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha.